Okay. Studying Paul's prison letters, as they're typically called, the letters written while he was imprisoned in Rome. Hopefully we'll be finishing up Ephesians this evening. You remember we talked about how Ephesians is split pretty evenly in halves. The first three chapters really focus on that idea that all spiritual blessings are to be found in Christ. Well, what does the second half of Ephesians focus on?
Therefore, how should I live?
Yeah, if all spiritual blessings are in Christ, walk worthy of them. Act like it. Live according to those things. Live in harmony with those things. And really, we spent Sunday evening talking about that. Here's something for you. Talking with a friend of mine this evening and before class, and he was mentioning to me how a friend of ours who's been preaching about 65 years refers to Ephesians and Colossians. And when he studies Ephesians, he refers to it as the theme of it as the church of the Christ. And then Colossians is the Christ of the church. There's a similarity there, right? And we talk about how these overlapping themes between those two letters. But there's also a distinction to be made, and it focuses on different things. So keep that in mind. The church of the Christ, Ephesians. And then Colossians, the Christ of the church. And I think you'll see that, especially as we get into the book of Colossians. That helps me to remember. Okay, chapter 6, verse 10. What does it start talking about? What does Paul start talking about here?
The
armor of God. He paints this picture for us of basically a soldier in his armor. So let's look at that. Not the prettiest picture of a Roman soldier that could be found, but I think it'll work for what we're going to look at this evening. Let's actually start and read in 10. We'll go through. No, we won't. We're going to go through 13. We'll talk about a couple of things and then we'll come back. Let's start in 10. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. A couple things that we see here. First of all, if you're putting armor on, what's the point? Why does Paul use this imagery at this point? It's a fight. Was it Chuck?
For protection.
Yeah, okay. Apparently, not only is it a battle, it's a life and death battle, but it's not a physical life and death battle. It's a life and death battle for your soul. And this is how serious it is. I do believe, and the reason I have a picture of a Roman soldier up here, this is the armor they would have been familiar with when this letter comes to them. These are the soldiers that they see, you know, on a regular basis. So we'll make the comparisons there. Notice verse 12. For we do not what? Okay. When you think about wrestling, what do you think of? Was that Roy? Yeah, it's a contest. Good. What else do you think about it?
Struggle.
Okay, it's a struggle. What is the
competition?
There you go. Oh, no, Jamie, that's exactly the point I want to make. When you wrestle with somebody, do you shoot missiles at them from the other side of the continent? If you're wrestling, where are you?
Up close and personal.
You are right in the middle of it. It is grappling, and it's close quarters combat. That is what our battle with sin is like. Now, we would like for it to be way down the street and keep it over there. But sin's not going to do that. Sin's going to try to get just as close as it can and pound its way in. And if we're going to be successful against it, we better be able to fight. And it's, you know, you watch football and they make all these war allusions. And they talk about the guys down in the trenches. The guys who are getting dirty and getting their hands on. That's the kind of fight that's being pictured here. It's not pretty and clean. It is rough and it is dangerous. And we better be ready to fight like that. Go ahead, Bobby.
The Romans used to be known for their gladiator fighting. And
yeah.
They would fight until one was dead.
Yeah. We're going to talk some more about this armor and some of the things that it suggests. Good. It's close. It's personal. Verse 12. Look at the second half of verse 12. Who are you fighting against?
Satan.
Yeah, this is a spiritual fight against spiritual power, specifically Satan. Satan is your chief enemy. Therefore, verse 13, what do you take? You take the whole armor. And this is another one. We talk a lot of times about The gospel is not like a buffet dinner where you just go and I like this and I'll put this on my plate. I don't eat that stuff, so I leave it. We can't do that. You have to take the whole thing and get the whole picture. When it comes to this armor, and we'll read it and describe it in a little bit, which of those pieces can you leave off and be protected or be successful? You leave one of these off, you're leaving a gaping hole. Do you think Satan will take advantage of it?
Yes.
He will bust us wide open. That's what he's looking for. You can put all this stuff on and he's still going to hit hard. He's going to try to puncture this armor. So keep that in mind as well. I love this. And just when you see things that are repeated, God only has to say things once for it to be a fact. When he says a word or a phrase over and over and over again, do you think he's trying to say something? Look at verse 11. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to do what? Stand. Good. Verse 13, therefore take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to what?
Stand firm.
How does verse 14 start?
Stand therefore.
Do you think he's telling us something? Now what does it mean? Now we can look at it and say, okay, he says stand three times in four verses. Good. It's good that we recognize it. And what does it mean? What does that mean in this context to stand?
You got to get up. You got to get ready.
Okay.
I mean, if you're sitting down, you're not ready for a fight.
Yeah.
If you're standing up, you're aware of what's going on.
Yeah. On guard, prepared, ready. And not only that, I take it, and we'll talk about more of this when we talk about the breastplate. This is not fleeing. This is not standing up so you can run away. This is standing in readiness, moving forward, preparing to engage is the idea there, man.
Yeah, to stand firm, you think about brace yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Brace for impact. Good. Tim.
The whole Isaiah 59 connection here with God putting on his armor to overcome the injustice of his exiled Israel, to bring him back, to redeem them, to take vengeance against the powers of darkness. And it's that very imagery that Paul chooses to use right here. And I always grew up thinking, this is the armor of God. But I didn't realize this was the armor of God. This is God's armor.
Yeah.
That he himself put on, that he is calling us now to put on.
Not the same thing.
That same armor. And whereas we're not the ones coming down and wreaking vengeance, we're using his armor to stand and appeal to him for that victory.
Yeah. One thing, I know this is armor, and I know that it is equipment that we are to put on, but never forget the fact, and I think the last point when it talks about prayer encompasses this, you're still not standing alone. You can put all of this stuff on, but if you lack him, you're not really putting this stuff on, right? Without him, none of these pieces work and none of these pieces are complete. Mark your places and turn to Joshua 7. I just want to look at a couple of points here in Ezekiel. Joshua 7, Achan has sinned. He has taken what was God's, and certainly God's wrath is against them because of this. You remember, he takes some of the treasure of Jericho, and then the Israelites go up to fight against Ai, and it should be just easy, but then they just get stomped, and they come back, and poor Joshua's thinking, Lord, what in the world's going on here? I mean, you brought us here to do this, and now we're getting put on the road by the people of Ai. Look at verse 11, it shows us the context. Israel has sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant, which I command them. For they have even taken some of the accursed things, and have both stolen and deceived, and they have also put it among their own stuff. Therefore, okay, so what did Israel do? Let's just sum it up. Just say it simply. What did they do? They disobeyed, which means they sinned. So they have gone against God. So therefore, verse 12, the children of Israel could not do what?
Stand.
We have been talking about stand, 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 stand. But if we are disobedient to God, what is absolutely impossible for us to do spiritually?
Stand.
You cannot stand. You cannot do that thing. Look at verse 13. I believe it's repeated again. Get up, sanctify the people, and say, sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, because thus says the Lord God of Israel, there's an accursed thing in your midst. You cannot stand before your enemies until what? You've got to take it away. Now, here's the thing. In the midst of all of these pieces of armor, what else? And they really all, it all goes together. What kind of heart are you going to have to take that you're putting this armor on?
Well, the very fact that this armor is pointing to God, all of these things are only valid if you have that relationship with Him.
A pure and holy and a righteous. Great.
And committed.
Commitment. Commitment and diligence are inferred in all of these things. This is not, you can put it on one day and take it off the next. This is a constant thing. Go to Ezekiel 22. We'll look at this and then we'll go back to Ephesians. And the reason I bring this up in Joshua and again in Ezekiel, they didn't stand. Would God have helped them to stand in both cases? He wanted to. He desperately wanted to. Look, and this plea that you see, I mean, it's a rebuke, and I know it's a rebuke. It's at verse 30 is what we're going to look at. But this is sad. And when God looks down on this, how brokenhearted must He have been to see after everything He had done, and then verse 30 comes to pass. Look there. We'll just start reading in verse 30. So I sought for a man among them who would make a wall and stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land. What's God looking for?
Strong and committed to stand against them.
He says, I'm looking for godly men. I'm looking for men who will be men, who will be holy and righteous. And then what does it say?
Found none.
Would stand on behalf of the land so that I should not destroy it. I found no one. How sad are those words? Did Judah know what they were supposed to be doing? Had they been told what was right and what God expected? Had they been given examples of what was right? Had they been given a law? Yeah, we've been given all of those things to a better level. And yet still, what did they have to do? What was their responsibility? Do it. Stand. You be obedient. So we can have the law. We can have the sacrifice. We can have the long-suffering and the grace and the mercy. What still must take place? Do it. The faith to do it. To do these things that He's commanded. And they didn't. This stands out as a not only a warning, but maybe an accusation against us when we don't do that. All right, going back to Ephesians chapter 6. Verse 14. God Himself provides the armor. But what is Paul's instruction? Put it on. So it's available. For every Christian, this armor is there. But we have to put it on. Can you imagine a Roman soldier about to go into battle, and he comes out of his tent in the morning, and he just, and we mentioned before, if you just grab a couple people, what if he just grabs his sword and his helmet? And he says, these barbarians, I mean, they probably couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. I just take a helmet and a sword. That's all I need. What's going to happen? Most likely, they are going to wipe the floor with him. And it's the same thing. It's true for us. We have to put them on. So let's look at the pieces in specific. What does it say about the waist? Wait, did someone read that for us?
Fashion on the belt of truth.
The belt of truth. Okay, here's our picture. The belt of truth is in the center. It is the thing that holds everything together. The other pieces are, it has the connection. It shows that the center of your body is the balance. What does everything else in our faith, what is it based on? What are all the other pieces based on? What if you don't have truth? I mean, good luck having righteousness and faith and all those things, because if we're not building everything on truth, that foundation, everything else is going to be faulty. Everything else is going to fall apart. Next, the breastplate of righteousness. What did the literal breastplate do? It protects those vital organs, right? You know, the heart and all of those other organs. It protects from that oncoming attack there. What breastplate is this that's being talked about?
Faith.
breastplate of
righteousness.
Righteousness. And we've talked about what that means. Rightness. Moral uprightness. It's fascinating to me. No back is described. And somebody mentioned this in one of our classes maybe a couple of times ago. What does that suggest? Yeah, I shouldn't be running away. Move forward. Keep moving forward. And God does. He's with us. He's protecting us. There's no need to flee. The feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. I think we can leave out some important parts. We can say, well, feet shod with the gospel. That's not what it says. Feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. So what does... Oh, well, first of all, let's do it like this. What did those...
I think they're called caligades, if I remember right. The sandal boots that the Roman soldiers wore. What did they do?
Well, one thing, it protected the ball of their feet. And if your feet are not protected, then you're not going to be able to stand very strongly.
Good. One thing that, if you look through there, they're leather... And to us, they look like sandals. They don't look very impressive. But they were. They actually took nails and drove them through the bottom and then rounded them off so they formed grips. Is that important when you're fighting? It's like cleats, right? You grab it, which allows you to do what to your ground?
Stand
it, which goes back to the whole point he's been making. Stand your ground. These things would have helped them to do that. In addition, now let's make the spiritual application. What do you and I stand on? Spiritually speaking, what do we stand on?
The gospel of peace, right? So what a great parallel that you see getting used here with these. Following after that, the shield of faith. What do shields do? You know, that's the thing about enemies. They usually don't stand there and let you bludgeon them to death. They usually hit back. Who's our enemy, according to this? Does he hit back? Oh man, does he? He hits hard. He throws fiery darts. He throws fiery darts like deceit and lust and greed and arrogance. And you pick. He throws those things. What must we be able to do when they get hurled at us? Deflect them. Great work. That's exactly what shields did. So what is our shield?
Faith.
Now how does that work? Explain it to me in spiritual terms. How does faith become a shield for the saint?
Faith is the motivator for us to be doing what we're supposed to be doing. It allows us to grow. And instead of walking in the wrong place, we're walking in the right, we're standing where we should be. Instead of leaving ourselves open.
Yeah, good. Faith is connected. Oh, go ahead, Kristen.
If bad things are happening around you and your faith is strong, you know that God's got a plan and it's all going to be okay. I mean, it's tough times, but your faith is going to keep you going and keep you strong through it all.
Is there a connection between faith and hope? Absolutely believe there is. Faith is trusting in God. That's easy to say. Faith is evidenced by trusting Him so much that you do what? You do what He says, right? I mean, that's it. When you go to the book of Hebrews and there's that great hall of faith and you see, by faith, this one did this. They trusted God enough that they said, this is what He wants. This is what I'm going to do my best to give Him. But it's connected to hope, right? Hope and trust in Him. I believe He's going to do what He said. I trust Him and I'm throwing myself out there. I believe He will do His part. I'll do what He's asked of me. They go together. Helmet of salvation is the next thing mentioned. You know, physically speaking, helmets were important, right? Your brain bucket, you know, it protects some very vital things there. Helmet of salvation. Why do you think those two are connected? The helmet and the idea and the reality of salvation. What's the connection that we might can make? When I think of helmets, I think of your eyes, right? They need to be open so you can have vision to see where you're going, to see what you're doing, right? The old phrase, keep your eyes on the prize. What are we looking toward? What is the prize? What is
the
Okay. Salvation. That makes sense to me. The helmet of salvation. Because as Kristen mentioned, bad things are going to happen. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what how faithful you are. Bad things will happen to you. Satan will make sure chance in this life just will make sure that bad things happen. So what keeps you moving forward? The hope of salvation. We're going to see that in Colossians as well. That Christ in you, hope of glory. That is the thing that keeps us moving forward there. So I think there we can see a connection. And then, of course, love. What is the weapon that's mentioned here? I know this guy has a pilum. That's a short spear or a javelin. But he also has at his waist, what?
Short sword.
A sword. What is the sword mentioned by Paul in Hebrews chapter 6?
Sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God.
Okay. Why is that? Obviously, it's a powerful weapon because it's the only one mentioned. Why is it powerful?
Because sin.
That's what Christ used to run off the devil when he was tempted.
Yeah, absolutely. And that whole scenario there, Christ's temptation, is an example for us. How do you resist temptation? How do you fight back when temptation is all over you? You cut it. What do you cut it with? Sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. I think a connection with it here, also Hebrews chapter 4, verse 12. For the Word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit and of joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. Can you do work with that? I believe we can. And that's the weapon that's named and that we're given here. Okay, any other thoughts? There's still one more, but we're going to talk about prayer. But any other thoughts on these? Yeah, Chuck.
I think I want to point out, and it sort of, I guess the thought that came in my mind was more of the British versus the, you know, when the British came over to fight, and they would stand in a line, and they had their own little rules of engagement. And then they lost because
it wasn't... Guerrilla tactics.
Yeah. We were not following by the rules, quote unquote. It's the same thing with the devil. The devil don't play by rules.
Absolutely not.
So you can be prepared for anything, be prepared for the next day. Because he's going to throw whatever he can at you, and not necessarily what you're used to being having thrown at you. He's always going to throw something else extra in there, some other little thing, something to drive a wedge or whatever it might be. He's going to look for any kind of weakness, even when you think it's a strong point.
Yeah. Another thought, that just as Chuck was talking there, made me think, this is none of what I'm about to say takes away my individual responsibility, but what made the Roman armies so very effective against barbarians?
So many of them together.
Their organization.
Tactics.
Right? What did they do? How did the Romans fight?
As a unit.
Yeah, that overlapping unit, right? When where one soldier ends, basically the other begins. Can you fill in some gaps like that? Can we make an application to the church from that? You know, yes, I need to be standing on my own with God's help. I need to be able to do that. But what has He given me? Given me you guys who are also carrying a shield of faith. So when my shield may not be lifted like it should be, do I have someone who can help me? It's a great, great blessing. Again, I know when judgment comes, Chuck can't stand there for me, and Les can, and Sasha can, and I wish they could. But you can help me now, right? You can help me get to that point. And when I'm weak, and when I'm tired, and I just don't want to fight this fight anymore, I just want to go home and lay down, you can pick me up and say, a little bit further. A little bit farther. And then it's incredibly powerful when we think of this. Been talking about the unity of the church. Here's just one more aspect of it that we get to see. Kristen.
It's kind of building off what everybody's been saying, but back to the faith and the being our shield and so forth. If our faith is weak, that's when the devil can get into us. And I've seen it recently in someone close to me, and so it's kind of... Yeah, you know, so we've got to keep our faith strong. And like you said, we have each other to help us when we do feel weak. But if we go run away from the family, and then we're all by ourselves with our shield not working very well, there's the that doesn't leave us a whole lot of hope.
Oh, man.
So we just got to remember when we are weak, we need our brothers and sisters more than ever, and to help. Don't run away.
That's a great point. What happens? You got them in the phalanx, and then one guy decides that he's going to go off over here. Well, now what happened? He doesn't have the support of that team. That it's structured. Every joint, every piece is fitted together for the growth and the strength of the whole. Well, what if this piece just decides to go do his own thing? He is going to be in serious trouble. And another thing that we do for each other, going on the idea of a shield. What if your shield's got a big old hole in it? And you don't appear to be paying attention to it. What should I be doing for you? What do you think these guys would have done for each other? When they came back and did an equipment check and they saw a gaping hole in the shield, do you think anybody might have mentioned it to one of their brothers in arms? Man, your shield's got a hole in it.
What's it affects their safety as well.
It does. It does. You are worried about him, absolutely. But if he goes down right there, does that affect anybody else? Affects me and him and him and him and everybody else around. This team aspect of it is extremely important. And I do hope we see it. Tim, go ahead.
Every time we go out on a mission, we actually check each other's equipment.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a bona fide reason for that.
And what if? What if you don't go out on missions very often? And you don't use your equipment very often? What happens?
Malfunctions.
Yeah, how do you know this stuff's not ready? These things had to be oiled and cleaned and taken care of. What if my equipment's garbage? And I don't know because I don't ever use it. And it's dried out. Yeah, I know we're taking that metaphor pretty deeply, but can we make applications from this? If I'm not using this stuff and making sure that it's ready and up to par like it should be, I'm not going to be ready when the heat of the battle comes on. I need to be ready. Bobby, you go ahead.
It kind of reminds me of what Christ told Peter before he went back to heaven. He said, Satan desired to have Peter so he could sift him as wheat.
Yeah.
But he prayed for him.
Yeah. Which leads us to the last verse in this section, right? Leads us to 18. But we'll get to that in a second. Chuck, you had something.
I was going to say, you mentioned, you know, if you don't use your armor very much or your equipment rusty and whatever. Another way of looking at it is, okay, you got such good armor, great. But don't let it just sit like that there, because there's always going to be this bigger, better thing out there. Always continue to study and strive harder to build your armor up and make it stronger.
Let's talk about one piece real quickly, the sword of the Spirit. We've used this example before. These soldiers are trained, right? They're well trained in using their swords and using them together. What if you take somebody out there who's never been trained in the use of that sword? What's he going to be like?
He can hurt himself more than...
It can be dangerous, right? Is there a lesson that I can apply when it comes to God's Word, the sword of the Spirit, in that? Study to show yourself approved. You know, a worker who does know how to rightly divide the work. Don't sling that thing like a crazy man. Make sure you're precise with it and you know how to use it, because not only is it a danger to your soul, it's a danger to everybody who hears you if you're misusing it. So we could go on and on and on. I mean, this is a beautiful picture that's painted for us here that we can make a lot of applications from are about the spiritual fight that we fight. Yeah, Tim.
Point going back to the shield with Satan throwing his darts. Paul makes the point there in 2 Corinthians with a brother that was caught up in adultery and who had repented, and some were still giving him a cold shoulder. And he said, confirm your love towards him, because, you know, much tomorrow, if you leave that guy out in the cold, he finishes up by saying, we're not ignorant of Satan's devices. He is going to use that.
Yeah.
And it's that connection that we have with one another that directly affects that faith.
So do we see ourselves in the middle of a war for souls? This image should show us that. Do we see the interconnection between each other in this battle too, because it's extremely important. Okay, let's go on to 18. I want to make sure we get through this section this evening. praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints. So what are you to do? Pray. Who are you to pray for? All of your brethren. Keep them in mind. They're fighting this fight too. And for me, I love verse 19. Because when we read about Paul, what do you think? What have you seen over and over again? First missionary journey. Second missionary journey. Third missionary journey. Journey to Rome. He's in the middle of a shipwreck and everybody says we're all dead. What is Paul doing? Strong and firm. And you think, man, I wish I had faith like that guy. And yet, what is he asking for here? I need you to pray for me. The apostle Paul is asking his brethren to pray for him. That should be an important message for us. If he needs that, certainly you and I do as well. Okay, moving through toward the end, you have basically this final greeting there. He mentions that Tychicus is going to come to them. Anything else they might want to know about his situation, when Tychicus gets there, he will fill them in on it. So it appears that Tychicus is the one carrying the letter. Actually makes sense. He's going to be carrying more than just the letter to the Ephesians. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And he finishes with peace to the brethren, love with faith from God the Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. What a great lesson, a great letter for the Ephesians. Any other points you want to bring up? You can go back to the armor if you'd like. Just anything you'd like to point out in Ephesians there. Terry.
In verse 18, it talks about watching. You know, Christ talked about the strong man. You know, if he hadn't been watching, he wouldn't have allowed his house to be broken in. So we got to always stay and watch.
Yeah, that idea. You know, it's amazing. Some of the imagery that you see in the New Testament has been used in the Old Testament so many, many times before. I mean, you see that idea of the watchman. You are the watchman. What is the watchman's purpose? You warn him. You tell him what's coming. Tell him when the enemy is coming. And then, of course, there's that other aspect of it. If you warn them and they still stay in bed and do nothing, your hands are free. I mean, you're free of their blood. But if you don't warn them, whose fault is it now? Now it's on you. So it's all of these ideas we can make applications from as well for us today. Good. What else? Bobby.
In verse 12, there we talk about the wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness in this world, and spiritual wickedness in high places. Wouldn't that include crookedness in our governing authorities?
I think in this aspect, because of what he says at the beginning part of verse 12, I think the focus is on the spiritual battle, because he specifically says we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. Now, the aspect that we're going to have to resist evil in this world is given in a lot of other places, so that's certainly a Bible principle. I do think the focus here is on the spiritual warfare, though, because of that phrase, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. I really think the focus here is on spiritual Satan and those who would be agents of Satan who would bring the spiritual dangers. So, Mike.
Just one thing about faith being our motivation and our hope. Sometimes when these flaming darts or arrows are hurled at us, they might not seem bad. They might seem pleasurable. You know, all sins might seem tempting. You know, it's short-lived. It might seem like something that we would have fun or enjoy doing. And if we don't have that faith and that hope and that motivation for a real goal, you know, we get sidetracked from those things that might be tempting.
Oh, that's a great point. That's where the idea of discernment comes in. You know, discernment is a fancy word that means to see. See it for what it is. Be able to tell what it really is. Guys, if sin wasn't pleasurable, nobody'd ever sin. Right? Hey, nobody'd commit fornication if it wasn't pleasurable. I mean, come on. Satan knows this stuff. He knows. That's why it's tempting. That's why these things are a problem. So Mike's point's right. You may get blindsided and not even realize you're being poisoned. And the dart's been in for a year. That's where the discernment comes on, the awareness, which goes back to, as Chuck mentioned earlier, be on guard. You can't ever sleep on duty, right? You're always on duty as a Christian. Good thoughts, Chuck.
Know your enemy. Any soldier that goes into battle, they not only are prepared as in themselves as far as their armor and their know, their weapons or whatever, they also know their enemy.
Yeah.
But regardless of how good your armor is or whatever, if your enemy, if you don't know your enemy, he can still work one over on you.
To use Chuck's earlier example, if I'm doing what the British did and standing out in a nice, neat line and thinking Satan's going to play by the rules, he is going to rip me to shreds. I need to know how he works, and I need to know that it is through deceit, and it's through building on my own puffed up arrogance. He'll use all of that stuff to cut us down. Good thoughts. Okay. Good with Ephesians? All right. We've got a couple minutes. Let's talk about Colossians for a second. The letter to the Colossians, as we mentioned a number of times, is often called a companion letter to that letter to Ephesus that we just studied. Very similar content. Notice, go ahead and turn to Colossians if you will. Notice in Colossians 2, verse 1. Unlike with Ephesus, Paul knew the Ephesians very well. He'd spent a lot of time among the Ephesians, 3 years at one point. He stayed there with them. It appears that Paul had not spent any time in Colossae. And notice what's said there in chapter 2, verse 1. For I want you to know what a great conflict I have for you and those in Laodicea, and for as many as have not seen my face in the flesh. Which appears to suggest what? They'd never been there. He didn't know them in person, but did he know them? He certainly knew of them, and word had been brought to him. And it does appear that Epaphras is the one who has brought him word of them. And from the way things are worded here, I tend to think that Epaphras may be the one who started the church there in Colossae. I think you can make a case for it at the very least. Look in chapter 1, look at verse 7. What's said here about Epaphras. He's speaking of the gospel, verse 5, verse 6. It's come to you. It has also in all the world. It is bringing forth fruit. It is also among you since the day you heard and knew the grace of God in truth, as you also learned from whom? Epaphras, who is our dear fellow servant, who is a faithful minister of Christ on your behalf, and he has declared to us your love in the Spirit. From that, I take it very likely that Epaphras is the one who has had a huge influence on teaching these guys the gospel. If you go to chapter 4, verse 13, you get a taste of the connection between him and the Colossians. They are very, very close. Epaphras, very, very worried about them. He's speaking of him in verse 13. For I bear him witness, he has a great zeal for you and for those who are in Laodicea and those in Hierapolis. I have a map up here for you. Ephesus. Come on, man. Ephesus is here. Certainly there on the coast. Colossae is about 100 miles, almost due east of there. It's in the Lycus River Valley. What you'll notice is what they call the Tri-City area. So here is Colossae, here's Laodicea, and right here behind the red dot there is Hierapolis. So those churches are very, very close together, and we can see where it's going to talk later. Share this with the Laodiceans, and you take the letter that they have, and you make sure that it's read among you. Well, that would be pretty easy to do, wouldn't it, for these guys? I mean, they're, 15 miles apart? That's not a big deal at all. So we kind of get an idea of the layout there of those cities. I like to see it. You know, we talk about cities, and now we're talking about, well, he's in Macedonia, and now he's in Ephesus, and now he's in Rome. And in our mind, if you're not looking at a map, I have no idea what you're talking about and what's in between there. I like to see these and see these connections. Also, if Tychicus is going to take the letter from Rome to Ephesus and to Colossae, do we see how that could be done? That's not a problem. If he takes a boat to Ephesus, can he get to Colossae? Yeah, I mean, basically, he's got a straight shot through. He can follow the Meander River, and he goes into the Lycus River Valley, and he's right there. It is really a straight shot. All of this stuff, I know it's not necessary for salvation, but it helps to see. It helps to see the reality of the situation. Just for me, it makes the whole thing easier to understand. A couple more minutes. Let's, at some point, look back at Colossians 1, verse 7. At some point, Epaphras visited Paul in Rome, told him about the faith of the saints there in Colossae. Paul writes to them. We actually read that one earlier. Look in chapter 4. He's going to send, this is where he tells us, chapter 4, verses 7 through 9. He's going to send Tychicus, our beloved brother, faithful minister, fellow servant in the Lord. He will tell you all the news about him. I'm sending him to you for this very purpose, that he may know your circumstances and comfort your heart with Onesimus,
a faithful and beloved brother who is one of you. We'll talk more about Onesimus when we study the letter that Paul writes to Philemon. So it's interesting to see, apparently it's Tychicus and Onesimus traveling with these letters. And again, maybe this doesn't matter at all. Can you imagine? There was a time where a man named Tychicus had in his satchel the letter to the Ephesians and the letter to the Colossians. And he is walking or riding or sailing. He's got those letters on his body. There is no way he could have known how much good those pieces of scroll would do for thousands and thousands and thousands. How many people have grown in the Lord because of Ephesians and Colossians? How many people have been convinced to obey the gospel because of those books Tychicus is carrying? It sends chills through here. God protects him and makes sure he gets exactly where he needs to go. And now those two letters have been preserved for us for thousands of years, and they're still just as powerful today when we read them as they were when he first delivered them to these churches. Guys, this is incredible. I hope we see God's providence and the role that he allowed his creation, mankind, to play. Could God just have sent this word to a prophet there at Ephesus and just had him say it? Could have. Could have done it that way. Instead, he sends it through the hands of a messenger. Yeah, just amazing stuff. Well, let's make another couple points. Epaphras. We find out in the letter to Philemon, this is Philemon verse 23, that Epaphras also becomes a prisoner at some point. In Colossians chapter 1, verse 1, who else is with Paul and greets the Colossians with Paul? Timothy. Timothy is there with him. Chapter 4, verse 10 tells us that Aristarchus is there. You remember Aristarchus traveled with him from Rome. And we also find out in this book, Aristarchus is his fellow prisoner now. So Epaphras, by the time of the letter of Philemon, is a prisoner. Aristarchus is a prisoner. Paul obviously is a prisoner. What do you notice? Things are getting a little rougher for Christians. And we see certainly it's not the level of persecution it's going to be in a few short years, but we can see how things are intensifying. And yet they keep doing it. They keep preaching truth because it is truth. Let's just finish up with the people who are there. Mark, if you turn to chapter 4, verse 10. Mark is there. Who is Mark?
John Mark.
Cousin of Barnabas. Here's where we find out the relationship between him and Barnabas. John Mark, if you remember, joined Paul and Barnabas for a while on the first missionary journey and then decided to leave and go back. Barnabas wants to take him on the second missionary journey. Paul chooses to take Silas instead. They go their separate ways and everybody preaches the gospel. So this is, again, here is Mark. If Mark's there with him, apparently, how does Paul feel about old Mark by the end of writing Colossians?
He leaves instructions.
Yeah. Yeah, notice what he says about him there. With Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, about whom you received instructions, if he comes to you, you remind him, I'm still mad at him for leaving me on the first missionary journey. You tell him, welcome him. Welcome him. Right? He is profitable. He is profitable for the gospel. That old John Mark grew up. He grew in time and persecution and all these things have certainly made him grow. Good. Luke is with him, verse 14. This is actually the verse where we find out a little something about Luke. We always talk about Luke, the beloved physician. This is where we're told. Luke, a physician there. There's another guy there in verse 14 who was with Paul at this time. Who is that?
Demas
at this time is faithful in the Lord. What's going to happen? By 2 Timothy?
He's
forsaken me, having loved this present world. So, again, it's sad. Every time I read, you know, I get excited. I'm reading through. Oh, man, Mark is there, and Epaphras is there, and Luke is there. And oh, Demas. Demas is there. And Demas is faithful because I know what's coming. There's going to be a point where he's not. Kind of heartbreaking. But we see the reality of it. Let's stop there. I heard that bell go off. We'll talk about the letter to the Laodiceans that's mentioned in chapter 4, verse 16 on Sunday. Thank you, guys.